crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Christopher Eames, for today. I just got back to England from a two-month stint in Jerusalem in our offices over there, working together with the Nagtegales, and especially working for Dr. Elot Mazar. We've been progressing well with processing material from the last excavations we had on the Ophel, just south of the Temple Mount. As many of our listeners will be aware, we sent several students to the Ophel at the start of this year for a three-month excavation. We excavated a cave, a large cave on the Ophel, made it all the way to the bottom, and an area just outside of that cave. So what we've been going through is processing the material from those finds. So it was great to spend some time there, catch up with the Nagtegales, and work with Dr. Mazar and her multinational array of personal assistants. One of them from Serbia, one from Russia, one from Argentina, myself from New Zealand, Dr. Mazar from Israel, of course. So a very multinational crew there. And it was great to work with them, to discuss different things about each of our countries. Really enjoyable time and really interesting to see these new discoveries coming out with regards to the cave. Of course, after the excavation happens, there's a lot of processing work that goes into documenting what we found. There's a lot of cleaning that happens. So a lot of rusted metal objects go through the cleaning process. And we can determine much later on what the extent is of what we've discovered, any interesting metal items or coins. We just got back the official summary of the coins and the dating of the coins. So some really interesting information there that will be compiled and is in the process of being compiled into the next Ophel volume, a large volume that Dr. Mazar is producing. So it was a real pleasure to help her out and to help the Nagtegales out in our offices over there. It was great also to take some other smaller trips, shall we say, around Jerusalem itself. We took a little visit to the Givati parking lot excavation that has been happening for many, many years now, continuous excavation that has happened on the lower slopes of the City of David area, or upper slopes of the City of David, lower slopes of the extended city of Jerusalem as extended by David's son Solomon. And this area has been excavated quite a lot over these past few years and is currently under the direction of Yiftach, a good friend of ours. And he took us on a tour around his excavation. We saw a really interesting golden earring that has been discovered. You can read about that on the Times of Israel. I forget the exact time period it dates to. I think it's the Hellenistic time period. Really interesting golden earring and some other very interesting discoveries as well. Of course, his site has been made famous for possibly being the site of the Acra, the Seleucid Acra, that was a very oppressive fortress over kind of domineering Jerusalem during the Hellenistic time period, looking down onto the temple compound, controlling that area. So that area has been put forward as the potential site of the Seleucid Acra. So some really interesting discoveries there. Of course, it was great to talk with Dr. Scott Stripling, the excavator of Tel Shiloh. Of course, that was the site of the tabernacle before it was moved by King David to Jerusalem. So we had a discussion with him that was posted on Watch Jerusalem, I believe, a few weeks ago. Really interesting. If you haven't heard that interview, I'd encourage you to check it out. They've made some really excellent discoveries down there, one in particular of a pomegranate a small carved pomegranate. I believe it was carved of ivory. I can't remember exactly now, but the pomegranate is well known as an item used within the religion at the time period by the Jews, by the Israelis, there in Shiloh, when the tabernacle was there, and in Jerusalem. There were a lot of religious rituals obviously going on at the same time, so it's really interesting to have this discovery of a pomegranate attached to the site, and it really helps corroborate the biblical record that Shiloh was a very important site, religious site for the Jews. We also, or I personally took a walk around the Davidson Center, and that's a large archaeological center that borders with our excavation site on the Ophel, just south of the Temple Mount. You can walk around there. There's a lot of really interesting discoveries that were made by Professor Benjamin Mazar there with our ambassadors during the 1960s, during the 1970s. And what was of particular interest to me was a stone that was missing from the Western Wall, just above the prayer area. And if you've been watching the Israeli news much over the past month, you would have seen a lot of discussion about the stone falling from the wall. Now, there were a lot of religious leaders that came out speculating as to perhaps some divine reasons for this stone falling from the wall. There were a lot of archaeologists that were counseled about what to do. Should people still be even praying at the Western Wall if rocks are going to be falling down? So this is the first rock fall like this, single rock falling for a while, and it really has worried some people. It was quite amazing that no one was hurt or killed, because of course this happened a day after Tisha B'Av, the period of mourning for the destruction of the temple. So the day before, there had been a huge amount of people on this prayer platform below, this wooden prayer platform, who were praying, and then the day after, this stone falls and smashes into the platform below. If you look at the video, there is a woman just off to the side who was praying, who was just missed by the stone. Some really scary stuff. And a lot of the archaeologists that have been contacted have said it is fine to continue praying at the site. One archaeologist has said it's not fine, it's too dangerous. So there's a little bit of dispute there. Dr. Mazar was counseled quite a lot about what to do, about details. She was interviewed quite a lot while I was there with her on the radio. Her phone was constantly going just after this event happened. So it was quite humorous, actually. She'd be helping us with doing pottery reading, choosing various artifacts to present in the upcoming volume, and she'd be on the phone giving these radio interviews at the same time. So she was counseled quite a lot for what the public should do and what should be done in order to help conserve the Western Wall and protect people below. But it's great to be back here in England again, and I'll be planning to do a lot more writing now for Watch Jerusalem. And there's been no shortage of archaeological discovery here in England, the British Isles, Ireland, and that's due to the heat wave that has been coming across Europe and across these isles just over the past month or two. The ground has been browning off quite a lot and revealing some really impressive monuments that have been seen from the sky. A lot of burial mounds, massive monuments that have been found due to the ground browning off and the outlines of these monuments being seen. So there's been kind of a rush of excitement here, and especially in Ireland as well, with archaeologists working to uncover some new discoveries, one in particular at the site of Newgrange, and another tomb. I forget exactly where this one was found, with a massive engraved large monolithic stone that was found there. So a lot of interesting archaeology happening here in the British Isles as well. Of course, things have been heating up in Israel quite a lot lately. Seems there could be a full-scale ground invasion at any moment, what with the stepping up of rocket attacks into Israel from Gaza. And of course, just before that, there were the fire balloon attacks. Now, when I was in Israel, I didn't see too much of that. Wasn't affected by that at all in Jerusalem. But there is the knowledge that it's just a couple of miles away, just not very far away at all. But it's an odd feeling. It's a little bit otherworldly. We have all of this tension and violence going on the border, and you really just see it in the news. But knowing that it's not that far away. But when you do have the odd terror attack nearby, that's when reality really hits home. And while I was over there in Israel working from the Hebrew University, they had the 16th anniversary of the Hebrew University bombing that occurred actually right outside our area of work at the Hebrew University at a cafeteria where we would go occasionally to have lunch. Now, this happened 16 years ago. 9 were killed as a result of it, around 100 wounded. And there were also some bus bombings that happened around that time period. And one of the workers that I worked with, a Serbian woman, she told me she's only just started taking the bus again just because of these bus bombings that had happened in the past. And one bus she got on, she overheard two people having a conversation, arguing about whether the window should be open or the window should be closed. And the person who wanted the window open said that the passengers would be a lot better off if there was an explosion on the bus if the windows were open. And that really shocked this woman who I worked with, and so it really scared her off from taking the bus for a while, because where else in the world, really, especially in the Western world, do you think about something so mundane as taking a bus? And do you think about having to consider, shall I leave this window open just in case this vehicle blows up? It's really quite incredible and quite worrisome and scary, the kind of things that have to be taken into consideration just to go about daily life. So a really interesting time there over in Israel this past 2 months, working and talking about the situation with Dr. Mazar and her assistants. But it's great to be back here in England and to continue working from here. Well, we'll take a short break, but do stay with us, because afterwards we're going to discuss a very interesting subject, that of longevity, what the Bible has to say about the pre-flood lifespans, and a related archaeological discovery known as the Sumerian King List. Stay with us.
This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive. Thank you for listening.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm Chris Eames, your host for today. We've just been discussing a quick roundup of events in Jerusalem from my recent trip there. And now we move into a subject that has surely interested, at least for some period of time, every human being at some point during our lives, that of lifespan. Now, especially in today's society, we really have a lot of pressure to live for longer periods, to try and develop new technologies to increase the human lifespan. And a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the biblical story of the pre-flood lifespans, men who are documented as living up to just under 1,000 years long. Now, there's a new article coming out on Watch Jerusalem about this pre-flood longevity of the first humans, and an interesting artifact and what it has to say about this. Now, a lot of people dismiss this subject of pre-flood lifespan as mere myth, The Bible talks about Methuselah being the oldest living person at 969 years. He died the year of the flood. So certainly he perhaps could have lived longer had the flood not taken his life, but he was the oldest recorded person in the Bible. So he's together with a lot of other pre-flood figures who lived up to and beyond 900 years old. Now, is this myth, or is there any kind of corroboratory evidence that we can look to? Certain Bible apologists attempt to answer this question of the antediluvian lifespans by saying that the word for years is mistranslated and should be months. Now, while this does bring these long lifespans down to a lifespan comparable to that of today, there's another thing to take note of, because along with these lifespans, the ages of conceiving children are also given. So if we shorten these lifespans, we also need to shorten the age in which they conceive children. Now, that presents a problem, because this would mean pre-flood men around 5 years old or even younger were regularly running around impregnating pre-flood women. Now, the Bible is pretty forthright and plain about the ages of individuals, so that doesn't work, changing the years to months like that. The Bible is pretty clear, pretty plain about these pre-flood lifespans. So what was the cause of it? Was it some kind of environment before the flood that enabled people to live longer? Was it special divine help that enabled them to live longer, more nutrition? What could it have been? And is this really just a mythological story from before the flood? Now, there's been interesting archaeological discoveries of a list that has been known as the Sumerian King List. Now, I say discoveries plural because this list has been found in several different forms, in prisms and tablets and other different forms like that, dating back to 2000 BC, around 2000 BC. Now, the most famous of these prisms is the Weld Blundell prism, and this is a cuboid prism dating to about 1800 BC. Now, there are a couple of fascinating facts about the Sumerian King List. It lists the long genealogical progression of the Sumerian kings in different blocks. So the first block contains eight people. Now, these eight people ruled over the Sumerian kingdom for incredibly long lifespans. And at the end of their rulership, a flood came, according to this list, and destroyed everything. And according to other Sumerian documents, this flood story also contained the record of Utnapishtim, which is the Sumerian Noah. And there are a lot of similar details between the biblical account of the flood and the Sumerian account of the flood. We won't go into that for this program. You can look at our Watch Jerusalem article on that at another time. But what is interesting about this Sumerian king list is that these first rulers, eight of them in consecutive order, eight in their genealogical block, before a flood came along and wiped them out. And then after the flood, the following rulers only lived to much shorter lifespans. So a real parallel there to the biblical account. But what does seem to fly into the face of the biblical account is just how long these pre-flood people lived for. And the longest ruler of the pre-flood Sumerian king list is listed as ruling for a whopping 43,200 years, and the youngest ruled for only 18,600 years. So how does that work out? Well, there's been a lot of theorizing as to how this parallels with the biblical account, And quite an interesting theory has come out, because the Babylonian Sumerian system was based on a sexagesimal system, so that uses a base of 60 for their counting, whereas the Canaanite and Semitic language system, so that was that Semitic language was from which from what our Bible came from. Through that Semitic language, the peoples that spoke the Semitic language, their system was based on 10, so a decimal system. So the theory goes that there was a Semitic language, perhaps clay tablet, that documented these pre-flood rulers of incredible lifespans, and then a Babylonian scribe got a hold of this Semitic language document, and he assumed that these numbers were given in the base of 60, and in that way they were extrapolated out to be extremely long ages. Now, there's a lot more mathematical calculation that goes into it, and you can read this on our upcoming article in Watch Jerusalem on biblical longevity of the first humans. But put simply, their combined lifespans actually parallel each other. If this is indeed true, if this is taken into account, one working off a base 60 and one working off a decimal base. Now, what is also interesting is that the earliest Sumerian king lists had 8 kings in the genealogy before the flood came. Now, the Bible describes 10 generations, including Noah, that were on the earth up to the time of the flood. Now, it's interesting in comparing these two, because the Sumerian king list did not have on it the first man or the flood hero. So we can add those two, and we have 10, paralleling what the Bible has, 10 generations before the flood. Now, in the later Sumerian king lists, they do add those two generations. So we have 10 generations of extremely long-living people in the Sumerian king list, and then a flood comes along, destroys everything, and then the following generations start out at a much reduced lifespan. And we compare it to the biblical account, which is, in these simple respects, exactly the same. 10 generations of people living to an extremely long lifespan, a flood that sweeps over, and then afterwards a plummet in the average age of man. So really interesting discovery that has come out to do with these Sumerian king lists. Do look up our article, hopefully coming out this week, on biblical longevity of the first humans. Now, Josephus does have something to say on the subject as well. He says, regarding the longevity of the ancients and the fact that people naturally would take it to be myth, he says differently. He says, quote, "But let no one, upon comparing the lives of the ancients with our lives, and with the few years which we now live, think that what we have said of them is false, or make the shortness of our lives at present an argument, that neither did they attend so long a duration of life. I have for witnesses to what I have said all those that have written antiquities, both among the Greeks and the barbarians, for even Manetho, who wrote the Egyptian history, and Berosus, who collected the Chaldean monuments, and Mochus, and Hestius, and besides these, Hieronymus the Egyptian, and those who composed the Phoenician history, agree to what I here say, Hesiod also, and Hecateus, and Hellanicus, and Acusileus, sorry about my pronunciation. And besides these, Euphorus and Nicolaus relate that the ancients lived 1,000 years." So Josephus, the first century AD historian, goes through this long list of other ancient historians paralleling exactly what the Bible says. So is it just a myth, or can we see actual evidence corroborating what the Bible says, and can we actually prove this biblical account? So do go and check out that article on Watch Jerusalem. And the article also encourages that you check out our booklets, Does God Exist? And The Proof of the Bible. Like we always say on this program, on thetrumpet.com, on watchjerusalem.co.il, prove it for yourself. And another article, new article coming out to keep an eye out on, is one on the Canaanites and the Israelite invasion of the Promised Land. Was it genocide? Was it genocide? Many think so. I'll just give you a little teaser for this upcoming article as well. This is a quote from Richard Dawkins, the well-known evolutionist and anti-Bible writer, speaker. And he wrote the following about the Israelite invasion of the Promised Land. He says, "The Bible story of Joshua's destruction of Jericho and the invasion of the Promised Land in general is morally indistinguishable from Hitler's invasion of Poland or Saddam Hussein's massacres of the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs." So was he right? Was it a genocide? Can it be compared to these horrendous things that happened in modern living history? Find out for yourself in our upcoming article on Canaan versus Israel, Helpless Natives Against Evil Imperialist Power. Some really interesting facts documenting what actually happened there 3,500 years ago in Canaan. And with that as well, prove it for yourself. All the literature is available for that on watchjerusalem.co.il, on thetrumpet.com, all free of charge. It's all there for you. Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks very much for listening to Watch Jerusalem. Until next time, this is Christopher Ames.